from WABE in Atlanta. This is City Lights. I'm Lois Wright, says thanks for listening. This is our daily look at the art and culture of Atlanta and the creative minds behind it. Today, we're thinking about how experience affects the artistic voice. Children's author Judy Schachner takes a slightly more introspective turn with her latest book based on her and her daughter's proclivity for daydreaming. Jo Barry Carroll looks at how a shared culture has helped shape the Black American voice. He'll talk about his new book of African art, photography, and anecdotes. And first this hour, a story of a two-decade struggle for justice heads to theaters. Do stay with us.
Support for WABE comes from the High Museum of Art. Only weeks left to see prints by iconic pop artist Andy Warhol. Over 250 works on display, including Marilyn Monroe, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Campbell's soup cans. Tickets at high.org. And from WellStar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. WellStar.org.
The new film, Crown Heights, tells the harrowing true story of wrongful conviction and enduring friendship. Colin Warner spent 21 years in prison, wrongfully convicted of murder, and his best friend, Carl King, devoted his life to proving Colin's innocence. Today, we have in studio the actors who portray the friends, Lakeith Stanfield as Colin, and Nnamdi Asomugha as Carl, Casey King. We're also honored to have with us in studio the subject of the film, Colin Warner. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is unique, getting to bond with the character who you portray. Before filming, what did you all do to get to know each other?
So our director, Matt Ruskin, he made it a point that Keith spend time with Colin, I spend time with Carl, for a week or so, and just really get into their minds and, you know, what they went through in any sort of way. And Keith and I, we got to spend a little bit of time right before shooting, but the difficult thing for us was, you know, we're playing friends, but we're barely in any scenes together in the film because he's in prison and I'm out. But we were all able to spend a little bit of time and get closer. Mm.
Well, Colin, I know this must have seemed so strange to you when movie stars and a prominent director approach you. What were some of the things you wanted to impress upon Lakeith and Nnamdi, along with writer director Matt Ruskin, as they were making the film?
Well, upon meeting Nnamdi and Lakeith, I just want them to realize that I was an ordinary human being, no fanfare, and went through a situation that I believe a lot of people are going through right now to this day. I'm very proud of the movie and the ability to tell the story, which has been going on for now 37 years. And I believe people out here need to hear the story, my story, which is also their story.
Yes. You know, as I was watching the film and knowing your story, Nelson Mandela came to mind, and I know your prison terms overlapped. Did you think about him?
Yes. I think about everybody who were wrongly convicted, because I feel that in the land of the free, home of the brave, the greatest country that is being purported to be, I believe that in the justice system and there's no fair play. I wasn't given a fair chance of proving myself. Everything was taken away from me. And I believe that in itself is a crime.
Yes. Lakeith and Namdi, from talking with Colin and your own research, what was the most important thing for you to bring to the screen in each of your roles?
I wanted to make sure that I, chiefly remained raw, remained true to the original material. One of the things that Matt Ruskin provided me with in preparation for taking this role on was the original transcripts from the hearings. Reading these words was an interesting sort of situation. So it's an interesting sensation passed over me reading this, knowing that these are actually the words that a person had said to Colin. And some of it I couldn't even believe that, people have come to say this kind of thing. But resituating the fact that this story is real in my mind made me realize that I had to try and be real to the material as much as I could. So it was important for me to do that. And I didn't want to approach it in a way where I was attempting to act as if I had spent 20 years in prison, because I knew that was impossible, because that experience is so specific. So what I wanted to do was take emotions that I had experienced and sort of expand upon exploring them and apply them to the material and attempt to get across a message that way. And also use some of the stories that Colin had told me, some of the family members he had showed me, some of the experiences that he had so bravely opened himself up to allowing me to see, in order to sort of inform the way in which I would walk into the role. Also, I went around to different prisons and stuff and visited a lot of people. But I really just felt it was chiefly important to show real raw emotion and not try not to fake it. So I went to extra lengths in order to sort of put myself in a position where I could do that more effectively.
And for me, it was simple. It was just his Carl's big heart and his resiliency. I felt if I could portray that in an authentic way, then it'll get his story out. But he's a larger than life type of guy, and the film focuses a lot on the most difficult points of his life. So it was definitely a challenge, but that was the goal for me.
Namdi, I have to say that watching the film, I would not have known that you spent most of your career as a professional athlete, a phenomenal football player, elite football player. Did you study acting when you were a kid?
In college? No, I didn't. Ooh. I didn't. It's Keith, who's also, just been blowing us away in everything he's done. He also didn't study acting per se. I think it's just there are life experiences that you have to be able to draw from. And I think life is kind of the best acting class that you can take. I think anybody can go into these roles, and if you can tap into some of these experiences, then you'll be able to bring them out on camera.
I think, I can't remember if it was listening to a podcast or reading, but you made the point that your experience was nothing like Colin's, but you were arrested for driving while black, and you drew from driving your mother's car at that, wasn't it?
Yeah, but so, unfortunately for me, I didn't know that it was registered to her business and not to her, and the cop used that as a way to say that I stole the car.
And the LAPD had no problem.
Yeah, no problem, and that was it for me.
If you are just joining us, I'm speaking with actors Lakeith Stanfield and Namdi Asomugha, along with Colin Warner. We're talking about the film Crown Heights, based on Colin Warner's wrongfully imprisoned term for 21 years. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for WABE comes from Nissan of Noonan. Nissan of Noonan, a fresh approach to the car buying experience. Their number is 844-FRESH-15, online at nissanofnoonan.com. And from Innovation Arts and Entertainment, An Evening with David Sedaris at the Fox Theater, author, humorist, and contributor to This American Life, an evening of readings, book signing, and Q&A, Sunday, October 22nd, tickets at foxtheater.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our 30th anniversary retrospective with three interviews from 1987, with Max Roach, who invented modern jazz drumming, pianist Jay McShann, who led the band in which Charlie Parker first became known — McShann was at the piano for our interview — and singer Anita O'Day, who inspired many of the so-called cool jazz singers. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE. We're back with City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes, here with actors Lakeith Stanfield, Namdi Asomugha, and Colin Warner. Their new movie, Crown Heights, was based on Colin's wrongful imprisonment. It comes out in theaters in Atlanta tomorrow. Colin, you have told your story so many times. And in fact, in public radio, we take great pride in the fact that the hour-long episode of This American Life provided the inspiration for the film for Matt Ruskin. And as Lakeith mentioned, the parole hearing scenes were pulled entirely from the transcripts. Does rehashing your story through radio and now through having made this film, does that give you any solace, any consolation?
Well, it's kind of therapeutic.
It is.
Yes, because from since my arrest in April 10, 1980, that was my mission, to have my story be heard, and hopefully those in situations of power or influence can see what is going on and release me from the this terrible ordeal that I was going through.
Casey is such an amazing friend. He devoted his life to getting his friend out of jail, and he even became a legal courier and investigator. I mean, that part of the story almost feels like a thriller, you know, a detective kind of story. Did you have any relationships in your own life that drew on to some of those emotions that you put into the trust and dedication and care of someone else, Namdi?
No, I mean, probably I do. I'm pretty sure I do, but I didn't draw on any of that. I think there was one thing that I drew on was just the fact that Keith and I didn't get much time to spend before shooting, so there was this longing for, you know, something that you didn't have.
Yes.
So I think that was one thing that I was able to draw on, the fact that I didn't know what was going on with him. You know, I think that was a blessing for us. And then the other thing was the experiences that I had growing up that we talked about earlier. I think being able to draw on those and just know that I was fighting for not just Colin, but my younger self, so I could draw on that to play the role too.
Although Colin's experience was just exponentially beyond what, you know,
you could
being
imagine.
Arrested for driving while black. Lakeith.
It just sounds like
I love that. It's coined.
Yeah.
It's.
Just going back to that other question, it's like there's so much of a natural process that occurs offset oftentimes.
Yes.
That influences, no matter what happens, it all influences what you see on the camera. I've learned that in sort of going through the process a couple times now. There are things that I've done to try to make things happen that have either made those things happen or made them not happen. And there have been things that I haven't done that have made things happen or made them not happen. So it's an interesting game to play behind the scenes to create a situation in a space that will affect what happens on camera. And sometimes those things are good, sometimes they're bad. Sometimes they're rivalries, sometimes they're friendships. Sometimes the best rivalries make the best friendships and vice versa. So it's an interesting thing navigating that and being offset. But one thing about, you know, interacting with Nnamdi Offset, he just has a big heart himself. Naturally, he's just a really pleasant guy to be around. And sometimes you get in these situations where you meet people like this, and you're just like, why are you so nice? I don't understand. The world is crazy. How are you so, you know? And I remember a moment in the story where Colin just, you know, he becomes pretty frustrated with his circumstance. He's like, why are you doing this, man? Why are you still doing this after all this time?
Yeah, I've given up. Yeah. Why are you still hanging on?
Right. And I remember in that moment thinking about how nice Nnamdi is and how, you know, forthcoming he is, and then just thinking about, you know, that, like, why are you so great, you know, to me? I don't deserve it, you know? So.
Well, Lakeith, people have seen you so far in more comedic roles, from Atlanta to the incredible Jessica James. Even Get Out had some humor to it, although it was creepy and terrifying, gave me nightmares. This film has real life horror, the horror that Colin endured. So was portraying Colin. Has that been your most challenging role?
Oh, God, it's very challenging. It's difficult for a person with a mind like mine to compartmentalize experiences in that way, to say what was the most or what was not the most. There's just so many different avenues, and I always try and put my best foot forward, so every role is really difficult. It's some avenue or another. But this one in particular was... It caused me to have to go to certain parts of my mind that I've never really had to explore. Two nights ago, I just had another nightmare. I thought I was done with them, of being pursued by law enforcement. It's such a weird thing, because I'm like, I don't know how it creeped into my subconscious in some weird way, but, and maybe it's other things tied in with the experience of this, but it didn't start happening until I started working on this film, where I'd have dreams of being pursued by law enforcement. It's very weird. But I had another one, and it felt really real. I felt like I'd done something, but I didn't know what I'd done. And then I'm just running around, and people are chasing me and trying to lock me up and put me in this cage, and it's a recurring kind of nightmare that I keep having. And that's kind of weird.
Was it at the end of the film that you mentioned over 120,000 people are still imprisoned for crimes they didn't commit?
You know, that's a part of the film that really made me irritated, is the fact that so many people are still locked up, but so many people got scot-free and got to just live their life and enjoy their life while these people's lives are ruined. That's a part that really bothers me when it comes up in the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, the film is not just a cautionary tale. It's a morality tale, and I think that it will have a profound impact on everyone who sees it. One can only hope, Colin, that it inspires more action, resistance, organized opposition to what is going on in our prison system. Yeah. It has just been a privilege to have you here, Colin Warner. Thank you. And Lakeith Stanfield, Nnamdi Asomugha, your portrayals are magnificent. I bet Colin would even weigh in that your Trinidad dialects are very good.
Yes, indeed.
Authentic. Okay. Colin Warner's story was the inspiration for the new film Crown Heights. He was joined by Lakeith Stanfield, who portrays him in the film, and Nnamdi Asomugha, who portrays Carl Casey King. Crown Heights opens in select theaters around Atlanta tomorrow. Thank you all.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from Jewish Kids Groups, a new kind of Hebrew school designed for Jewish families of all backgrounds, including interfaith, featuring experiential learning in a welcoming environment. More about Sunday and after-school programs at jewishkidsgroups.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. When athletes retire from a sport, they may pursue related jobs such as coaching or team management. NBA All-Star Joe Barry Carroll took a different path following his love of fine art and writing. He has devoted recent years to creating his own works, mostly paintings. Several of those paintings appear with personal reflections in his 2013 memoir, Growing Up, in Words and Images. Mr. Carroll's new book is titled Black American Voices and pairs photographs of African art with text from a variety of contributors. I spoke with Joe Barry Carroll in advance of his appearance at the Decatur Book Festival this weekend, starting with the inspiration for the project.
It kind of came out of a process that I was involved with. I'm a trustee for a collection of African American artifacts and carvings and figures that one of my professors from Purdue owned. And I was photographing them, and they begin to tell stories. You know, you feel things when you separate them individually. They begin to communicate. There's a certain music and song and storytelling that they provide. And over time, I decided to couple that with family albums, not my family necessarily, but just any of our families, regardless to what community we come from, as people tell their stories. Everybody has a story.
Indeed. And you match them with the corresponding piece of art. These are mostly sculpture, aren't they?
Yes. In this one, this is carving. And there's some pottery. But different people have responded in different ways with it because we're all so different. Some people focus on the African art, which is beautiful and stunning. And then some like the storytelling of the photographs because they're photographs throughout that correspond to the African art. And then the storytelling about who this person is and something interesting about their lives.
Well, tell us more about Tony Zamora. You said he was a professor of yours at Purdue?
Yeah, I call him a professor. He's actually the director emeritus of the Purdue Black Cultural Center, but he's the kind of the caretaker of all the children, the 1,000 black students out of 30 or 40,000 students at Purdue. He always was kind of our, you know, the vanguard for us, and we all have a special, you know. Matter of fact, when I ran into his collection, I was just going running by their house when I was back at Purdue collecting my work from the exhibit I had back there. And I was just going to run by and hug their neck and say hi to he and his wife. And I ran into this just treasure trove of artifacts, and it was incredible. And he's 85 and in that certain season of life. And we talked about it, and he agreed to trust me with it. And so I'm the trustee, and I'm trying to get it out and have people understand.
How many pieces?
I have 500 here.
Ooh. And yeah. These were all on display in their home?
Well, loosely speaking, on display. Remember, they're people of a certain age, and they buy what they like, so they just put it over there with the anticipation of doing what I end up doing, which was cataloging it all and storing it.
And will it be donated to a museum at a certain point?
We're trying. That's part of what this project is about, is hopefully that it will create a certain kind of awareness around how beautiful the work is and that there will be an interest in it. They're community servants, so they've been very clear with me that it has to be something good has to be done with it.
I'm curious about how you decided which essays or commentary should be featured alongside the various photographs of the artwork, you know, sort of like a chicken and egg. Which came first, Barry?
I don't remember exactly. I just know that some of the figures necessarily are compatible with the photographs. Because so you go through the photo, I'll go to family albums or through some of my friends or people in the community, their photographs, and match that with the African carving. Because I wanted to establish some type of relationship. Because sometimes African work is just exalted, and it's in this place that people feel that is so high and far above everything that it can't integrate into our regular lives. Initially, it's just the aesthetic, what looks like what, you know, how familiar are things. And then from there, I write the story.
You write the story, or you ask these various contributors to write?
Well, I had to condense it because I listen. I'm a big fan of, you know, StoryCorps and Studs Terkel and all these people. And one of the things I enjoy is like when you ask the question and let them just go. So they would just go on and on about their stories, and I would try to basically edit it down to what would might be interesting to the general population.
Well, let's start with the piece on page 21. You had mentioned that you thought this was a good starting point. Tell us about the photograph that appears.
Okay, so Ephraim Bailey is this career Atlanta Police Department, you know, big broad-shouldered man, big gun and everything. But the most fascinating part about him is when he tells a story of how he met his wife. They've been married for 34 years. And he told me this story, and I was just like, it's got to be in the book.
And what is that story?
Well, would you like me? I'll read it.
I would.
Okay.
Like you
okay. So imagine he's in middle school. And so the picture in the book for the listener is that she's looking, there's a picture, a close-up shot of he and Sheila. I telephoned Sheila Millsap one day after school. I told her, my name is Ephraim Lamar Bailey, and we are in Miss Johnson's homeroom class together. I'm calling to tell you I want to go with you. Sheila's answer to me was, my mother and I are watching our stories on television. I will have to talk with you about this tomorrow. The next day, I walked her home from school as we entered our life together. We've been married for 34 years now. Ephraim Bailey, Warrensville Heights, Ohio.
And it's a beautiful photograph of two sculptures. Are they sculptures or carvings?
These are carvings. They're called swervers. It's a kind of a traditional expression in African culture. This notion of swervings, where you have the man and the woman looking at each other in kind of an angled way, which is kind of interesting because it's, I guess, a metaphor, perhaps, that how in order for us to have great relationships, we have to adjust our perspective to kind of incorporate the other person. So you see this kind of angler view that they each are having.
It is beautiful.
But I just think that's a great story. And the few people have, you know, it's early. The book was just released 2 weeks ago. So that's one of the more popular stories in there.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights. Our guest today is Joe Barry Carroll. His new book is Black American Voices, which features essays from various contributors alongside photos of African art from the Zamora Collection. Carol Quiller, Jacksonville, Florida, has an essay I found especially moving. Would you read it?
Okay. This is a friend of mine that actually lives here in Atlanta. And I was struck, we were having dinner one night, and she was speaking about the sensitive, the approach she has to we were talking about communication. And she talked a little bit about how she approached during her job, because she's working with these variety of cultures. And it was just instructive to me, as well as, I think, enlightening for us as we consider other people who are not us. In my work, I serve nonprofits in underserved communities from Alaska to Mississippi. I work with tribes and communities of every stripe to help them comply with government relations, regulations, and filings. Before any work begins, I find it helpful to seek first to understand the folk I'm dealing with. I need to be sensitive to their culture and what is important to them in a way that will allow deeper understanding of the person, the tribe, and the community. Everyone and their way of life should be respected, their language, food, music, dress, and other cultural protocols. I spend time doing what seems unrelated to the chore at hand in an effort at showing respect. When I first acknowledge a community by respecting their ways, they become available to any conversation that follows.
I think Ms. Quiller belongs in Washington.
Well, I just thought it was perfect. And she's, you know, this high-profile, established professional. But she understands in order to, you know, get anything done, you just can't, you know, bully yourself into a situation. You got to open your mind and open your heart to
other
people's way.
Seems so simple when you just say that. And yet, not many.
Yeah, it's instructive.
Follow that. And the piece that is opposite Carol Quiller's comments is sculptural. Is it bronze?
Now, this is a carving.
This is.
And it's, I just thought it was beautiful because she's, as you can see, she's a very attractive woman. And, but the eyes that are, look slightly closed showed a kind of a meditative and reflective pose to it. And I thought it went perfect with her photograph.
The Zamoras, not surprisingly, are featured several times in the book.
Yeah, I had to because they fuss at me. It's so funny. I bet I...
This is an acknowledgement of inspiration or thanks or they're fussing?
No. It's all in good spirit. It's just so funny. I was just giving you backstories that they are in the book. I think in another world, perhaps the entire book would be them, but I thought I would be able to have more diversity in thought and concept if I included other people. But it's so cute to see these 85, 90-year-old people fussing at. I'm like 7 feet, 300 pounds. I've been all around the world. But to them, I'm still like this little kid with a book bag on the college campus. And like,
keeps you grounded, they Barry.
They just through the process, you know, because I would stop in and check in, let them know where we are. They'd give me a good talking to.
And look what you came
up with. I know. You know, teamwork makes the dream.
Well, on page 121, we see Tony Zamora playing his saxophone and a beautiful piece on the opposite page of a man playing an instrument. I don't know what it would be, but perhaps some ancient precursor to a saxophone.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought it was perfect because they're even holding the instrument, you know, left hand, right hand. Obviously, a musician carved this piece. Tony's, he had spent all those years in the university system. And when he retired, he recreated himself, or maybe he expanded on his career as a musician because he plays the saxophone and all reed instruments. But he's very good. He has as much a reputation as that as he does an academic.
And there is a very sweet, short but sweet, and touching essay on page 71 about twins and what it means to be a twin.
Yeah, I like that. There's a tradition in Africa, I want to say Nigeria, where when twins are born, there are statues made of them. And so, and it's a popular place. There's some majesty about twins. There's something special. People are we still remain fascinated by when twins come out, especially if they look alike. But this is Todd Coit and Tara Coit.
Would you read this?
I like the photograph is she and her brother now in a current time. We were all together socially, and it's a wonderful shot that I took of them. And then on the opposing page is the African carvings of the twins with cowrie shells as a dress. I like being a twin because it makes me feel different. Todd and I grew up being referred to as the twins. Some folk would greet us with, "What's happening, twin?" or "Hey, twin," as their way of declaring us special. Then there are instances when calling me twin springs out of the custom of our community calling things by how they appear. For as much as I've always loved my brother, our being each other's twin seems to add a layer of special to what is already wonderful. Tara Coit, Atlanta, Georgia.
So beautiful. Yeah. You know, because sometimes people would think negatively, oh, you don't have your own identity or you're tired of being, you know, considered one of two instead of the individual. And here is this beautiful acknowledgement of just how special it is. Those pieces of the twins opposite that essay. It those are exquisite with the shells. Do you have any idea of the age of these pieces?
It's really hard to tell. I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage with the Zamora collection because there's not a lot of documentation. They bought a lot of what they love. So coincidentally, their eye, their aesthetic, the things that appeal to them aesthetically also are significant pieces. In African artwork, in many parts of it, there's not a lot of identification, personal identification. So it's hard to trace because you won't, it comes, most of the work will come out of villages that are sanctioned by the king or whomever the leader is in the village. And sometimes it won't even have a name on it. So it's very difficult to track it.
You think about medieval churches, cathedrals, and, you know, the work and the architecture, the ornate interiors, and those are not signed either.
Right.
It stems from, I guess, a humbler place.
I'm not sure. I think there is some spiritual component to it. I'm not sure. It certainly frustrates those of us who would like to have more information, because I had to just make a decision at some point of what I would publish and what not, because I could not delve into the history. It would take too long. It would take a couple decades to figure out exactly where this place was and who this was and carbon dating and all that kind of stuff. So I just took that and I ran with it. And this is what we came up with.
The final entry in the book features a photo of President Barack Obama with Charlene Smith and
yes.
Imogen Smith. And the essay is from the Black Americans. Why did you choose that for the ending?
Well, there's a conversation within our community about how proud we are. None of us look at President Obama as perfect, but we are all clear that he's very good. And we're very proud of him, and we're very excited about what happened. And we joke sometimes that, man, he's the real thing. It's not like they just, put somebody up there. This cat was prepared, and he came ready to do it, and he did it. And we just didn't want to. Part of the essay says that we were not going to wait for history, because in retrospect, years from now, everybody will be clear on how talented this man is. Right now, there's debate for foolish reasons, but we are clear. We are clear.
And this essay and the faces, the shining faces, the pride of these people looking at President Obama.
Charlene Smith is the sister-in-law. Imogen Smith is the sister to Betty Zamora. And they worked in President Obama's campaign when he was a senator in Illinois. And they're in the back room. And you could kind of see the way they're looking up at him. It kind of reflects what ended up in the essay.
Well, it is an exquisite volume. I have to congratulate you on this. And I have to remind listeners also that you will be featured at the Decatur Book Festival.
I am on September 2nd at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, in the Marriott Conference Center, Room C.
Yeah. Come on out. We're going to show out. We're going to have a good time. I like to have fun. I don't, my readings are a little unconventional. So.
Well, and the book is beautifully produced. Joe Barry Carroll is the author of Black American Voices, Shared Culture, Values and Emotions. Congratulations on your second book, and thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Support for WABE comes from the Atlanta Women's Foundation. AWF's Women on Board program provides effective board governance training to Atlanta women and connects participants to nonprofit organizations. More info at atlantawomen.org. And from Renewal Design Build, providing kitchen and open floor plan renovations for InTown Atlanta. Your home, your life renewed. More information at renewaldesignbuild.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for joining us. If you've young children in your life, it's possible you're familiar with our next guest's work. Judy Schachner is the author of the Skippy John Jones series of children's books, which feature not only her goofy sense of humor, but also her imaginative and detail-filled artwork. Both are on display in her new book, but with a deeper message. Sarah Bella's Thinking Cap hits stores next week, and Schachner spoke with producer Mike Johns.
Judy Schachner, you're perhaps best known for your books about a certain Siamese cat who thinks he's a chihuahua.
Yes.
Do you see Sarah Bella's Thinking Cap as a change in direction?
Well, it's certainly a completely different book, and in between this book and the last Skippy book I wrote, I wrote a story about a raccoon named Dewey Bob who was, never met a button he didn't like. And I've written about my cats in real life. And so I've written, I think in all maybe 25 or 26 books, I can't remember. And a portion of them had nothing to do with the Siamese cat who was really my cat named Skippy John Jones. And yes, he did sound like Antonio Banderas. And yes, I did see a psychiatrist for many years. So this book is very different from that. And yet it has a lot to do with imagination.
Yeah. Can you walk us through the plot just a little bit?
All right. So Sarah Bella is a child who is basically an introvert. And she's quiet in school. She doesn't say very much at all, but she's very busy thinking. And sometimes children who, I'll just put it to you bluntly, this story is a combination of me and my daughter, Sarah. Some of the teacher's notes in the book are from my report cards directly. Every year, a teacher would say, Judy needs to focus and finish her work on time. Judy needs to get her work done. She has to stop daydreaming. And I have two daughters, and the youngest one, Sarah, was also a different kind of a thinker and learner from her older sister. And so quiet, introvert, but would go into her room, spend hours making different kinds of things. And I think, in school, we're still, no matter how far we've come along in education, and maybe we haven't come that far, kids are always forced to think, to fit the round peg in the square hole or vice versa. And when you don't fit or feel like you fit or you're not an extrovert, you still have a very hard time, functioning in school, getting those good grades. And no matter what people think, you still need good grades to get out of school. So this is a book for introverts who there's a lot going on in their minds, and sometimes we can't always tap into it from the outside.
What made you decide to write the story now?
Well, I had started thinking about this story at least 10 years ago, and sometimes it takes a long time for things to percolate and bubble to the top. And I had made an earlier attempt, and it just didn't feel right. And then I wanted to revisit the story. And I started making thinking caps out of paper bags and putting, painting them and putting all of the things that I love to think about. My daughters who live far away now, my parents, birds, trees, cats. So I decorated this paper bag and would wear it on my head when I visited schools. And it just got me thinking that, it'd be lovely if every child in school could make a thinking cap, especially those who are not great at expressing themselves verbally. And then we would know what they love to think about. So it just evolved. I make these character Bibles that are filled with collages of thoughts and ideas and paintings and words. And when I finish one of these character Bibles, then usually I have a book there. And Sarah Bella, it was the right time for Sarah Bella.
Yeah. thinking about that a little bit, the artwork in this book is, it feels like a whole other thing unto itself. It incorporates a lot of collage elements. It's incredibly colorful and expressive. Can you talk about your process in doing that a little bit? Like, did the story come first and then the art, or were you working on both alongside each other?
Both alongside each other. Making a book for me is like parallel play. So I'm not, I still have trouble considering myself a writer. I was never trained as a writer, and I only wanted to illustrate books for other writers. So for me, I have no trouble thinking of an idea. I'm very my books are very character driven. So I will draw and write along, you know, at the same time. And when the drawings get stuck, then I will work on the words. When the words get stuck, then I'll draw the pictures. And it's a very, as my editor likes to say, what one time she said to me, "Oh, you're the most organic writer I've ever worked with," or, you know, and I think that was just a way of her saying, "Oh my God, what are you doing?" I don't think anyone knows what I'm doing there, and I think they hold their breath every time I do a book. So
yeah, I mean, that could also be read as a pretty great compliment too.
I'd like to think of it that way, but I'm not sure she meant it that way. But I love my editor, Lucia Manfried.
In the book, there's the character of Mr. F, Sarah's teacher. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He's very important to the story. He recognizes the kind of thinker that Sarah is, and he has this wonderful way of both, like, kind of reining her in a little bit when he needs to, and also letting her run when he can. Did you have a Mr. F growing up?
I did. I had a third grade teacher who was about 100 years old. At least I thought she was. She had white hair that was like spun sugar. When she sat at her desk and I stood above her, it just had no beginning and no end. And it was all, you know, kept nice and tidy on her head by a little net. She could barely walk. She was crippled with arthritis. She had two hearing aids that would constantly make these high-pitched, you know, sounds. And yet she was probably the first person I felt totally comfortable with. And she recognized that I loved to draw. And I honestly don't remember a whole lot about that class or what it was about her, other than she was so kind to me, and I was very, very shy, and so she was maybe my Mr. Fantozzi. Mr. Fantozzi, in fact, is a teacher in the Wallingford Elementary School, whose class I was fortunate enough to visit and talk about thinking with all of the kids and making thinking caps. And I asked him if I could use his name, and I hope he's not going to be embarrassed, but he was great. He had nicknames for all the kids, and he had a very warm and wonderful way of working with the children. So, you know, I hope every child has a teacher that is as wonderful and as good at bringing out, you know, the interior life of some children as he was.
Do you make classroom visits often?
I used to make them, oh my gosh, a good portion of my, you know, my 26 years in bookmaking. The older I get, I just turned 66, the less energy I have. I find being an introvert myself, it takes an awful lot of energy doing school visits, and so it takes me a week to recover from one day. So I pick and choose, and I'm going on book tour Monday, so I'll be out on the West Coast, and I will be visiting schools out there, so but not as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I'm interested in the way that you communicate with children through your books. And knowing that you make a point to interact with them in, you know, where they are in their classrooms.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you get from those interactions. What the children that you've interacted with in these classrooms, what have they taught you about how to write for them?
Well, you know, I always consider myself a professional 8-year-old. I mean, my last good year in school really, and this is sad to say, but was, you know, it was third grade. And so I'm very much, I think, on their level. I have a very, very silly sense of humor. And, you know, the feedback that kids give you, the love, and is just, it, you know, if you could bottle it and just keep it in your studio forever, it'd be wonderful. But the most wonderful thing is visiting a school, you know, telling my story, letting kids know that I wasn't the stellar student in school, that I had deep issues. I had a parent, my mother was dying of cancer from eight years old on, and I didn't have an easy time. I struggled in school. I needed glasses and I didn't have any. So I love going into school and not so much talking about my books, but talking about how imagination saved my life, and how if an author had visited me when I was a little kid, it maybe would have changed my life, to realize that you can live by your wits, you can love art and grow up and have a career in art, and you don't have to be perfect in math, and you don't have to be a star. So I think, you know, having kids come up to me and say, you know, I struggle in school, or I have a parent who's sick, or, you know, just being honest with kids and having them be honest back, and they recognize kindred spirit. And so I think that's the greatest gift this work has given me, is being able to just go into schools and say, you know, I'm just like so many of you.
Well, Judy Schachner, thank you so much for the work that you do. Looking forward to seeing you in Decatur. Thank you so much for taking the time
today.
Oh,
thanks. I can't wait to see you, too.
Children's author Judy Schachner spoke to us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. She'll be in town for the AJC Decatur Book Festival at the Decatur Recreation Center on Sunday at 12:45 p.m.
Support for WABE comes from DK Gallery, the contemporary fine art gallery on the Marietta Square, presenting 1,000 words at First Friday Art Walk and Art Talk plus poetry readings this Saturday, 2 to 4, dkgallery.us. And from City Winery. The Ponce City Market Urban Winery, Music Venue, Restaurant, and Private Event Space is now open for lunch. Info about upcoming shows, winery tours, and their 2016 vintages at citywinery.com/Atlanta.
You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow morning at 11, the Fonz himself is back on City Lights. Henry Winkler joins us to talk about his latest children's book, written especially for kids with dyslexia. And Jerry Slater will mix some Southern cocktails from his new book in the Southern Foodways Alliance series. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. I'm Lois Reitzes. I'd love it if you'd follow me on Twitter, at Lois Reitzes. That's spelled LOISREITZES. The station is at WABE News. Thanks for joining us for City Lights and for listening to member-supported 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.